Coming into our final full day of practice now, and yesterday we finished the Satipatthana Sutta, so today we're doing something a bit different. So to begin with, just a few reflections on where we are in the retreat, where we are in the process, and how we might want to practice moving forward. We are approaching the end of the retreat, but we do still have a full day of practice time, so please use it well. This is maybe more of a concern, an in-person retreat when people are getting that kind of end-of-term feeling and starting to want to talk and do all sorts of things. But yeah, even when we're on our own in a home retreat, a private retreat setting, it's still worth seeing what we want to do with this last day of practice and making the most of it. If this is the first retreat you've done that has a big component of samadhi practice, or if you've had challenges coming off samadhi heavy retreats in the past, then you might want to start backing off on the concentration now and shifting the balance of your practice more towards insight, metta, that kind of thing, less on trying to get into jhanas, exploring jhanas, doing that kind of thing. It's very helpful to have some kind of grounding. That's why we have the insight practice every day, because it has a grounding quality to it. And as you're going back into your daily lives, it's helpful to really be fully there. I remember the first time my partner and I came off a retreat with Lee. We were at the cafe in the train station that's nearest to Gaia House, and at a certain point we realized we'd both just been staring at a coffee cup for 10 minutes without moving or saying anything. Our minds were just in that place where they wanted to just kind of rest on something and just stay there for long periods. And say, yeah, okay, we're not quite normal at the moment, are we? So yeah, you might want to think about starting to dial down the concentration. If you've done concentration heavy retreats before and you've had no problem coming off them, then yeah, fill your boots, practice however you want to. But as we do look beyond the retreat, it's interesting to think a little bit about that transition from retreat mode back to daily life mode. Concentration has this effect of zooming in on whatever you're concentrating on. Right? You may have noticed this. There's often people report things like, it feels like the breath has gotten really big, or it sort of fills your experience. And what's happening here is that with concentration, we're focusing very much on something in particular, and everything else falls into the background or disappears entirely. And so whatever you've been focusing on becomes your whole experience. So we can look at a retreat as being a kind of concentration on meditation practice. Daily life has been to some extent backgrounded. Now, we're all in different circumstances. Some people have had more going on than others. For some people, it's very much that seclusion of both body and mind, that real retreat feeling. Other people, yeah, there's been more stuff going on, dealing with families and so on and so forth. But for all of us, we've spent a period of concerted practice. We've been doing something that we don't normally do every day. We've been more focused on the practice than we usually are. It can feel really good to do a lot of practice sometimes. It's one of the appeals of coming on retreat, right? It's a nice thing to be on retreat. And it's a pretty common experience. If I'm on a bus or a train or something leaving a retreat, there'll be somebody there who was on the retreat with me who's saying, oh, this was amazing. I'm going to meditate 25 hours a day from now on. There's something really nice about that, because there's a strong aspiration to practice. There's a beautiful quality to that. But the rest of the universe has this way of not being quite so accommodating of our strong aspirations to practice. At some point, probably tomorrow afternoon, I'm going to have to turn my work laptop on, and all sorts of things are going to come just crashing back into my experience that have been safely put in a box for the last 10 days. So, practice time for formal meditation is often a lot less off retreat. We'll talk a bit more tomorrow morning about Lee's and Ayakema's recommendations for what formal practice should look like beyond the retreat. But I want to take a step back and look at things a bit more broadly. I said, I don't remember when, but earlier on, this isn't just a jhana retreat. This is a dharma retreat. We've got the metta practice, we've got the insight practices, we've been looking a little bit at sila and various bits and pieces. Buddhism has this eightfold path. It's a holistic thing. It's not just about meditation. It's a way of life. And so it's worth revisiting that Eightfold Path as we look at making this transition back into daily life. And so what I'd like to do for really the bulk of today's session is an exploration of the precepts. Now, you may or may not identify as a Buddhist. You may think, well, I'm not a Buddhist. What do the precepts have to do with me? But in the context of practicing an ethical life, I think that's a good thing to do whether you're a Buddhist or not. And the precepts give us a nice starting point. The precepts are some pretty solid pieces of advice for things that can be very supportive in living whatever kind of life we want to live. The thing about the precepts is it's relatively easy to keep them within a retreat container. You get your glass and your piece of paper to deal with bugs to take them outside the house so you don't have to squash them. That's pretty much the first precept taken care of. You're not really talking, so that's lying taken care of. You're probably not stealing things. You hopefully did enough preparation before the retreat that you're fully stocked and you don't need to go out burgling places to get enough food. Yeah, there's not a lot going on that brings up significant ethical challenges for most of us. Things get a lot more nuanced in daily life. There's a lot more going on. And so it's good, I think, to come back every now and again to this idea that the precepts are a training. They're not a set of commandments. It's not like Buddha said, thou shalt not, and if you do, then you'll go to Buddhist hell after you die. It's a practice. I undertake the training to refrain from taking life, and so on. This is something that's meant to be engaged with, not to be memorized and just rattled off when someone says, so what do you do? Oh, I keep the precepts. The first one is this. It's something to actually explore for ourselves. My personal suggestion for exploring the precepts is to interpret them as broadly as possible rather than as narrowly as possible. I sometimes see, usually on the internet, these kind of legalistic interpretations of the precepts, people getting really into, but what specifically does this like Pali fragment of a word mean? And so what specifically is covered or not by the precept? I actually Googled this for fun just before this morning's session. And I found, yeah, a forum post where somebody was picking apart the fifth precept to figure out exactly what it means. And it turns out that literally the fifth precept, which later on I'm going to give as refraining from intoxicants causing heedlessness, turns out it doesn't say intoxicants. It says refraining from the condition of intoxication and carelessness caused by beer and cider. There are two Pali words in there, and one of them is a kind of beer and one of them is a kind of cider. So what can we conclude from that? Well, the Buddha didn't mention crystal meth, so that's fine, right? Well, I don't think that's what the fifth precept is really getting at. You can play these kinds of games if you're really determined to do something and you want to sort of justify it to yourself and find a reason that it's okay. Well, the Buddha said beer and cider. He didn't say wine, and the scientists say that red wine is really good for us, so maybe that's okay, but I'll stay off the beer and cider. That for me has not been a particularly useful way of using the precepts. There's a practice in my Zen lineage, which is to go the exact opposite direction, to interpret the precept as broadly as you possibly can, so broadly that you can't possibly keep it. If we look at the precept on taking life, well, if we don't just consider, all right, if I personally kill a person, then that's bad. But what about taking life more generally? What about things like antibiotics? What about when life is taken by someone else but for your benefit? What about, okay, let's say you're vegan. Well, plants are still alive. They have to die so that you can eat them. So we can look at these things so broadly that it's impossible to convince yourself, yes, I'm a good little Buddhist. I have 100% on all of my precepts. I keep them without fail. Because we can look at them so broadly that you can't do that. And when we get to that place, then the question becomes, so what does sila mean? What does it mean to keep the precepts if on a certain level we can't keep the precepts? And this, for me at least, has led to a very interesting exploration of the precepts. What are the principles behind the precepts? What are the precepts trying to get at? And how does that map over to the decisions that we make day to day? In the world of moral philosophy, you get a lot of these kind of standard problems, right? The Nazis are knocking at your door and there are Jews hidden in the basement, or there's the trolley problem, right? There's a train that's coming down and you can flip a switch and it'll kill one person. If you don't flip a switch, it'll kill 10 people. I have never had a trolley problem in my actual life. I have never had to choose between flipping or not flipping a switch and killing some number of people. Those are not the kinds of ethical problems that come up in my life. The ones that come up are much more subtle, much more insidious, much more difficult to spot, and much less clear what the right thing to do is. And so I think having a really nuanced exploration of sila is something that's much more practical, actually, in the context of a non-monastic life when, we have all sorts of things to deal with. So what we're going to do, and we're going to spend about an hour on this, we're going to do a contemplation on the precepts. Now, I will warn you in advance, the contemplation is deliberately provocative in some places. I'm not trying to persuade you of anything in particular. I'm not trying to tell you what you should or shouldn't do. I'm not saying that certain things are okay or anything like that. What I'm inviting you to do is to see for yourself, what do you feel about these things? What comes up for you as you explore the precepts in this way? So, let me just turn off some notifications on my phone so they don't distract me. And then, let's move into the contemplation now. So, we'll start with a few minutes of meditation just to get settled. And then, for the bulk of the session, we'll be doing contemplation in the way I've been doing it so far. There'll be a sort of headline statement for each of the precepts, and then there'll be some probes dropped in as we go through to give you other angles to bring to your contemplation. You're very welcome to ignore the probes and do your own thing, or you're very welcome to use them however seems appealing to you. So, if you'd be willing for setting yourself up in a comfortable posture for some meditation and then some contemplation. And then let's take the next 5 minutes just to get settled. So, bringing your attention to whatever object helps you to get settled. Moving into the contemplation now. Refraining from taking life. Take some time to explore this in the broadest sense. Taking life could potentially include everything from killing another human, to stepping on an insect, to taking antibiotics, to cutting down a tree. What does taking life mean to you? How do you feel when you see or hear about life being taken? Does it make a difference what kind of life is being taken? By whom or for what reason? When is the taking of life justified? What might it mean for you to undertake the training to refrain from taking life? All right, moving on for now. Refraining from taking what is not given. Take some time to explore this in the broadest sense. Taking what is not given could potentially include everything from armed robbery to insider trading, shoplifting, taking more than your fair share, watching copyrighted videos on YouTube, taking up too much of someone else's time and energy. What does taking what is not given mean to you? How do you feel when you see or hear about someone taking what is not given? Does it make a difference what is being taken, by whom, or for what reason? When is taking what is not given justified? What might it mean for you to undertake the training to refrain from taking what is not given? Moving on for now. Refraining from sexual misconduct. Take some time to explore this in the broadest sense. Sexual misconduct could potentially include everything from rape to inappropriate physical contact to adultery, to using sexuality to get what you want from someone. What does sexual misconduct mean to you? How do you feel when you see or hear about someone committing sexual misconduct? Does it make a difference what kind of sexual misconduct is being committed? By whom or for what reason? When is sexual misconduct justified? What might it mean for you to undertake the training to refrain from sexual misconduct? Moving on for now. Refraining from false speech. Take some time to explore this in the broadest sense. False speech could potentially include everything from lying under oath to committing fraud, spreading lies about someone to damage their reputation, misleading someone in order to manipulate them, exaggerating your achievements to make yourself sound more impressive, telling a little white lie for social convenience. What does false speech mean to you? How do you feel when you see or hear about someone speaking falsely? Does it make a difference what kind of false speech it is, by whom or for what reason? When is false speech justified? What might it mean for you to undertake the training to refrain from false speech? And moving on for now. Refraining from intoxicants causing heedlessness. Take some time to explore this in the broadest sense. Intoxicants could potentially include everything from alcohol to recreational drugs, risk-taking behavior. Anything else we can get addicted to, gambling, the internet, even our work. Heedlessness could potentially include anything from total loss of control to significant impairment of judgment to a subtle lowering of inhibitions. What does intoxicants causing heedlessness mean to you? How do you feel when you see or hear about someone using intoxicants leading to heedlessness? Does it make a difference what kind of intoxicant it is, or what degree of heedlessness? Does it make a difference by whom or for what reason? When is the use of intoxicants leading to heedlessness justified? What might it mean for you to undertake the training to refrain from intoxicants causing heedlessness? And now, for the last 5 minutes, bringing your awareness back to your body, noticing what you feel and how you feel. Just resting here for a few minutes, allowing things to settle and integrate.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.